Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, continuing conversations about the cultures of consciousness. For some reason lately, I've been thinking about my situation in cultural history, in some sense, my age. And I guess I'm a Generation Xer, and I think that as the millennials push in with their own claim and cultural expression as adults, I'm more aware of the way that my generation is interestingly sandwiched between the counterculture, let's call it. At least from my perspective, the most interesting thing about those who came just before me, and this new digital generation, people who grew up surrounded at varying levels with the digital revolution, with the consequences of the internet and all of the social, political, cultural changes, psychological changes even, that go along with that. And I've increasingly considered that I was very blessed to sort of, in some ways, grow up during the birth of the computer revolution. Of course, computers pre-existed my birth, but which was 1967. But I got to see them sort of leak into the lives of ordinary people and move from the mainframes I saw in my father's lab to the early personal computers that a friend of mine's older brother had. He'd like crawl out of his room to watch Star Trek and then go back in and hack away, and then have the computers in the classroom early on, to sort of the transformation to that whole world and starting out writing on typewriters and moving on to computers, blah, blah, blah. But I'm increasingly think not only was I born during the sort of birth of this digital world, but I was also born in what I'm calling the analog sunset, which means the sort of fading away of a whole analog world, by which I mean not just analog media, vinyl records, Xerox mimeographs, books, film that's actually on film stock, and that whole sort of pre-digital kind of media, but also a sort of different way of relating to the world and to matter and to information and to social connection. And one place where this shift in my life between the pre and the post sort of internet, let's call it 1995 when the World Wide Web takes off, one place where I can see very interestingly differences and similarities, prophecies and transformations, is in the world of witchcraft and paganism as a popular religious practice or set of practices. I was always only a kind of dabbler in that world, like lots of the things that I've done. I'm sort of a participant observer, journalist, anthropologist, fellow traveler type. But I knew lots of pagan groups and went to gatherings and read into the literature pretty deeply starting in the mid-1980s. And so it was very, very interesting to see what happened as a lot of that energy and those ideas and those social practices went online, and actually in some ways in a very prophetic way. And what I mean by that, and as a way of introduction to our guest today, I'm very happy to say we'll be speaking with Aidan Kelly, that definitely qualifies as a most significant elder in the American pagan landscape, and I'll say more about him in a moment. But one of the interesting things is the way in which the pagan movement and witchcraft considered within that anticipated some very interesting changes that would come and become more popular and more widespread with the rise of computer bulletin boards, of the internet as a way of communicating information, but most particularly gathering people together, connecting people. And this is the idea of the network, that the way you organize a bunch of people, particularly a bunch of pretty independent, creative people who have very dynamic and transformative social relations, is not in some kind of old school hierarchy of a series of step ladders organized into some pyramid of social power, but instead you adopt the flexibility, horizontality, and distributed nature of a network. We use the term network all the time to talk about what we do. We go to parties, we network with people, we use networks to do this. It's an ambiguous term. But one thing it definitely refers to is a kind of a social organization that had a countercultural influence, a certain kind of religious or spiritual influence, and a very culturally creative sort of spin as well that emerges very clearly in the 1970s with the way that paganism and also the New Age kind of organized themselves as little pods of covens or groups who begin to interact and interface through personal connections and through media. In those days, of course, it was magazines or zines or bulletins or mail flyers, even mail art was a way to like keep these connections going and to build these webs that then themselves became more organized and self-conscious of themselves as networks. And we'll be talking more about that today with Aidan Kelly, who I'm going to now introduce. I'm very happy to have Aidan on the show. For those of you who don't know, the story is very long and complicated, but let's just say that he was played a very important role as both a writer and a practitioner in the founding and creation of certain strands of American paganism, particularly through the organization he helped co-found in the late 60s here in San Francisco, the New Reformed Orthodox Order of the Golden Dawn. And then he went on to write a very significant book, a couple books, about one of the key tensions in American paganism and witchcraft, one that particularly fascinates me and I think will fascinate many of our listeners, because we do talk about hyper-real religions on this show and the weird blends between fantasy and reality. And this tension that existed and to still some degree still exists, though less so, in American paganism, is between those who hold that the practices that they're inheriting or being transmitted to, witchcraft in particular, Wicca in particular, come down through a historically grounded current that was once underground and then became sort of announced and made more public in the 1950s with Gerald Gardner, but the people who participate in this current are tapping into a real history of cultural transmission that goes back centuries, if not millennia. On the one hand, and on the other hand, there are the people who say, well, we're influenced by a lot of things, including anthropology and including books about mythology and the history of Celtic peoples and the history of witchcraft, but we're also interested in science fiction and all sorts of things. And at some level, when you boil it down, contemporary paganism is an invention. It's a free creation of creative people, largely in the post-war environment, that may take certain strands from history, but is in many ways a poetic and social act of self-invention. And Aidan Kelly has done a great job both in manifesting and in articulating in complicated ways and interesting ways the second half of that tension. So I'm very happy to be able to speak to him with the because he's got a book out. And that's usually why we wind up talking to people on this show. And he has a new book that's the beginning of a series of texts on the history of American witchcraft, more than the broader category of paganism. And it's called A Tapestry of Witches. And this first volume goes through the mid-1970s. So with that all said, Aidan, thank you very much for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Okay. Well, thank you, Eric. Yeah, what you've said so far is very interesting, and I'd like to respond to a couple of points. I have to admit, Eric, my crystal ball was a little cloudy. If I had been able to predict what this weekend was going to be like, I would have had you schedule this for some other time. Well, the big problem is I have someone that we have to talk to coming at 3 o'clock. And if he's a little late, there's not a, sorry, there won't be a problem. If he's a little early, I'll have to sign off at that point, and I hope you might have interesting music to play or something.
No problem.
But it would only be a few minutes. You know, life's little realities.
They keep happening.
Yeah, I know. Okay, about your being Generation X. My generation is actually pre-baby boomer. I was born in 1940, and I remember what America was like during World War II. And then my adolescence was during the 50s, which was a very conservative period. And I was raised Catholic. I'm certainly not a Catholic anymore, but I still feel like I've kind of got a dog in that fight, so I pay attention. And when I was 14, I went through some interesting changes. And it was at that point that I'd had this breakthrough that I found a book. It was Theda Kenyon's Witches Still Live. And it began with a pretty able summary of Leland's Arati and the Gospel of the Witches of Tuscany. And it just blew my mind. You know, I'm 14, and I'm thinking, that's the kind of religion I'd like to have, if I can ever find it. And so I spent the next, it worked out to 13 years looking for it, and then with friends, it sort of almost created itself and became, you know, the New Reformed Orthodox Order of the Golden Dawn, which was really kind of a tongue-in-cheek name, because we didn't want to take ourselves too darn seriously.
Seems to be one of the that's one of the keys.
And the network thing. You're right. actually, Michael York, in his book The Emerging Network, talks about the fact that the pagan movement overall, like the New Age movement and several others, does have this structure of what the thing is a model called the spin model. And it means segmented, polycentric, integrated network. And what it means is that the real ongoing structure in the movement isn't in terms of the little local groups. Covens, you know, evolve and change pretty rapidly. But he said what's happening, and he can see, is that, well, the elders, I guess, the people who've been in the movement for a long time, stay in touch. You know, there's sort of a collective informal council of elders, and if there's some major issue that needs to be discussed, they know how to get hold of each other and talk about it and decide what, if anything, they need to do about it. And that really does exist. I mean, for example, I've known Starhawk for almost 40 years, and so on, for a lot of other people. I certainly knew Margot, and she was a wonderful friend. You know, I miss her.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to get to that, but since you brought it up, let's just talk about her. I mean, she with the recent passage of Margot Adler, one of the leading lights, and certainly one of the great writers and reflectors on the meaning of the larger movement, as well as her, you know, being an active participant in various goddess currents, and a wonderful journalist as well. So, I mean, I'd love to hear a little bit about her from your perspective and what influence her work had on you.
Marker wrote her autobiography called Heretic's Heart, and she was very much in leftist politics, which she got involved with when she was out at UC Berkeley, where I don't think we never connected on campus. We were there about the same time. And, she was personally involved with early stages of the pagan movement. And she had a pagan way grove in Manhattan. And it occurred to her to write, a kind of sociological description of what was going on with the movement. And she happened to run into a new literary agent who was looking for business and suggested this book, and the agent was able to get it signed, and so Margaret took off across the country interviewing people. And And she met me and the other Narug people out in California, and we gave her copies of the material we had developed, which she took back to New York and used it in her own coven. And there's a whole family tree that descends from that. We definitely stayed in touch.
It's also interesting, I mean, both in her case and in your case in a more academic way, it's interesting to me because you, I think, started getting your degree at the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley in the early 70s, in sort of the height of all the dynamics around these groups mm-hmm. and the changing, the development of new covens, and there's starting to be connections between different groups. It was a very dynamic time for you, and yet you decided also to go and get a degree. And in a way, why I raise it up with Margot is it seems to be there's one of the interesting things about paganism, and it's true today, but true back then, is that even people who were very active in it, in creating it and constructing it and living it and exploring it, imagining it, being moved by it, there was also a kind of space for work that we would think of as more scholarly, more self-reflective, more sociological, that those things were not, depending on different individuals and groups, of course, but for a lot of people, those things were not separate, entirely separate activities.
And so
what was your experience of that?
Well, one thing that I knew during that period when I was searching in the 60s was definitely a sense that if we were going to have some kind of new religious movement that would meet people's needs better, it had to be compatible with modern science. It had to be compatible with modern scholarship. You simply can't have a viable religion that's just based on obsolete concepts, And so the people attracted to the movement were people who were, interested in scholarship and serious research and science fiction. I know a statistic I ran into somewhere that really only about 20% of the American public ever reads a book, okay? But everybody in the pagan movement, and science fiction fans and like that, read all the time. So the membership is pretty much drawn from that top 20% of the population, which, gives it a very different vibe.
When you were let's talk more about the founding of the group, because I'd like to tell the story about how it came about, particularly because I'm really interested in how people begin in a sort of gentle and in some ways uninvested way to just experiment with reality. Have a ritual. Let's write a poem and recite it. Let's get together on Midsummer, whatever the elements are. And then after they've sort of invested some playful, exploratory energy into it, something else happens. And something else happens that pulls it forward, becomes its own thing, becomes a different kind of reality. And I'd really love to hear your account of how that happened in your own life with the founding of the order.
Mm-hmm. Well, it really happened. I mean, the starting point was that my good friend Sarah, we were very close, came up to me in the fall of 1967, and she was taking a graduate art seminar from the filmmaker James Broughton, and the firm assignment was to create a ritual that the class could participate in. And she knew that I had been collecting information on the Gardnerian movement for years and asked me if maybe I could write a ritual like that. So I did, and Broughton approved it, and we got a group of people together interested in working on it, exactly 13 as it happened. So we all worked on that, and we did the ritual for the class, and it went off well enough. But it certainly didn't produce any kind of altered state of consciousness, although the whole group of people sort of turned into an informal study group. We would meet just about every Saturday and read books and talk about everything under the sun. And then at summer solstice, we had an annual neighborhood picnic out on Angel Island State Park. And friends were going to get married, so we said, okay, well, we'll do a wedding. So we used the ritual as a framework for the wedding. And afterwards, sitting around talking, we realized everybody was saying, I felt something. That was different. And the difference was we weren't doing it as a play for a class. We were doing it as a liturgy for its own sake, and it did affect us. So that got us all excited, and we did a whole lot more work, and we put on our first real public sabbat for Lamas in 1968. And it worked so well, we were honestly stoned on the energy. And we were hooked. We knew it worked. And so the nerve has just been going on and evolving ever since.
And so for me, what I take away from that, and I think it's very beautifully said, is that you just set up a structure with a certain intention in a certain context, certain people, and then something happens, mm-hmm. something that you feel, something that is maybe mm-hmm. even enigmatic, hard to name even, and yet it has a kind of call to it. Over time, as that developed, how do you characterize that? What is that? How can you? I mean, I'm kind of asking an impossible question, but what is it that emerged that drew you guys forward? Was it just like you say, an altered state, a sense of something happening, or did it become? You know, how did that develop over time? That sense of what was pulling you forward.
Well, we sort of had beginner's luck with that first sabbat. It was a long time before we could get another one up to that energy level. But we could really feel it, you know, and it fluctuates, you know. And part of what kept us going, I mean, we would have public sabbats, you know, out in Gold Gate State Park. We'd have 200 people in the circle, and nobody paid any attention. I mean, this is a period of, oh, you know, war protests, civil rights marches, student riots at the universities and like that. Nobody paid any attention to us, you know. But it just grew. My second wife, Alsa, who is one of our major priestesses, commented when my daughter, Maeve, interviewed her that, yeah, really the key to it was that we had this huge friendship group from, you know, school and work and so on and so forth. So collectively, we knew hundreds of people, and many of whom were interested in what we were doing. And, you know, we've been attracting new members steadily. But we were also, it was democratic. We were all equals. In a sense, you know, I was hired as the writer and mouthpiece for three very powerful women who were our first three priestesses. And if I wanted something to happen, I had to persuade everybody else that it was the right thing to do. I didn't always succeed in that either.
Yeah. Well, one of the other things you guys did that was different is that at that point, I mean, if you took a cross slice of Wiccan groups in other pagan groups in the United States, and that's what your Tapestry of Witches does very mm-hmm. well, particularly around witchcraft groups, both Orthodox Gardnerians and a variety of other things. One of the things that seemed very a little different about you guys was you started holding open rituals right off the bat. You did not immediately go for this secretive inner circle side of things, which was also a very important part and is a very important part of Wiccan practice. What was that public gesture about? Did that have to do with the 60s, with the sort of sense of the changes in public space? And what was that about?
Well, it was partly a great many of us were involved with left-wing politics, and we were used to doing protests out in public. So having a very peaceful circle out in public was, you know, nothing scary about that. And we also had the advantage of we were bootstraps. You know, we were collecting what information we could to see if it was sufficient to get the thing to work, and it did. But we didn't pretend we had any secrets from anybody. You know? We proved that you could create good work. And, you know, when we were run into other people, like Gwydion Pentherwin and Allison and Victor Anderson, who really were, Victor really was an old-style pre-Gardnerian witch. And then we connected with Lady Theos, who was the queen of the gardenarians at that point, and their reaction was, wow, you really did manage to co-opt yourself into our religion. and we felt very pleased about that because that's what we wanted.
You know, you mentioned the word bootstrap there. Was that a metaphor you came up with back in the day? Was that something that you developed later on? It's such a wonderful way of talking about this process that can happen sometimes, where art or performance or imagination can inspire or even initiate into another order that then becomes more rich. Did you think of it that way at the time?
No, I mean, bootstrap was just a common term back. I think it came as an army term. The idea was you lift yourself by your bootstraps into the air.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I don't know, over the years, I mean, I spent the first 10 years with Nehru totally involved, and then I went through some personal changes and was definitely not very involved with it for about 10 years. And then I was able to come back into the movement much less intensely. And, you know, I've been involved with it since, you know, and also developing a lot of other interests and activities and so on. You know, my interest in religion in general is very, very broad, which is, you know, why I went and got my doctorate, which was really, you know, advanced humanities. I was able to study, figure out the actual history of Christianity, study Greek religion and literature, and I think figure out what the real secret of the Eleusinian mysteries was. And my that first book, Crafting the Art of Magic, you know, actually began as a research project for one of my doctoral comprehensives, because I wondered how in the world the Gardnerian movement got started, and there were a couple of clues in what Gardner said about what he had started from and how he added to it. And the I thought I'd never see, you know, the original documents, and then wham, they fell into my hands.
Right.
I mean, it was like Gardner had sent these documents to Charles Clark, who sent them to Carl Weschke. And apparently Gardner had told Clark he wanted the Book of Shadows to be published. Okay, and that's essentially why Clark sent them to Carl Weschke without a clear explanation. Carl didn't understand what they were. But when Isaac Bonowitz went to work for him as an editor of Gnostica, Isaac looked at this stuff and realized what he was looking at and immediately sent copies to me, because these were the original documents typed and hand-annotated by Gardner. And so I was then able to use the techniques I'd learned from classical scholarship and textual criticism like this to figure out a chronology of how all this stuff got written, and sort of sort out the what Gardner had started from and how he developed it. And Philip Hazelson's research, you know, has been very, very useful, because Philip figures out, no, there really was an original group, very small, that initiated Gardner, but what they were initiating him into was what you could call pre-Gardnerian witchcraft. Very little relationship to what Gerald Gardner then proceeded to create. You know, and something I did realize, too, you know, the Orthodox Gardnerians, who some of whom were very good friends, you know, seemed to, you know, want to live it according to the foundation myth, that it was a tiny secret cult spread only by word of mouth. Well, if Gardner wanted it to be that, he never would have written his books to promote it. Gerald Gardner wanted to create a major world religion that could stand up against Christianity or anything else. And at present moment, considering how the craft has grown, it kind of looks to me like he succeeded, you know, which, you know, puts him in a class with a lot of historical religious geniuses. I mean, Joseph Smith, Mary Baker Eddy are two obvious examples. But in a way, what Gardner set off is probably going to be even more important in the long run, because he did create this kind of religion that can be compatible with modern science and scholarship and doesn't depend on having to swear allegiance to what are really obsolete beliefs. Okay, I guess that answers your question.
No, that's great. That's great. That's actually perfect timing. I have a lot of questions, but we got to take a break right now. So you're listening to Eric Davis talking with Aidan Kelly on Expanding Mind, and we'll be right back after a couple messages. Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm your host, Eric Davis. We're talking with Aidan Kelly about the history of witchcraft in the United States. So, Aidan, I'm curious, as you are, as you said, a student of religion, looking at how religions have developed historically, Christianity, mystery religions of antiquity. When you published your research on Gardner, showing how much invention, creative construction there was, how much he was one of these religious virtuosi, especially in retrospect, there was a lot of reaction. Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of curious what the reaction to your research taught you also about how religions appear and work today in the modern world.
Right. Well, yeah, there was a reaction. The people who really wanted to believe fully in the idea that, the entirety of the Gardnerian movement had been preserved from antiquity, got upset when I instead showed how it had been created. But it's the same kind of psychology, though not as extreme, as, evangelical Christians who get upset when you tell them the history of how the Bible was written, that, they don't want to know. But one advantage here is that because I had the great blessing of actually seeing all the original documents, the very first version of the Book of Shadows, Ye Book of Ye Art Magical, which I saw up in Toronto when Ripley's had bought it from the Wilsons, who were, Gardner's heirs, really. By being able to see that, it gave me a lot of insight into how Christianity evolved, because the kind of detailed personal histories weren't recorded. What we have is only the formal, really mythicized description. There are patterns. There are patterns to how religions in general are founded and evolve, because they all have to meet the same basic human needs. We have religions because we need them. We have to have something that provides the basic values that we need to have in order to make decisions. Something like that.
It's an interesting question. I mean, that's something we're all, as I think a society, the modern West is wrestling with right now. It's very interesting because it's a curious time along these lines, because we, of course, have a very vocal, though much smaller in numbers than they sometimes sound like, atheist movement, a new atheist movement that's extremely vocal and has a lot of influence in academia, in mainstream media, who are saying, no, actually, we don't need religion. It gets in the way. And then on the other hand, we have examples of extreme fundamentalism all over the place, most of which are quite noxious to progressives, people who are interested in tolerance or interested in having a society that has liberal democratic principles with a distributed power, et cetera, et cetera. It's like, these things are these returns of some kind of almost a fantasy of medieval theocracy are also terrifying. And so there's this very strange middle ground now where a lot of people find themselves and where ideas of the New Age and to a good degree of paganism play themselves out. Do you see that there's sort of an inherent kind of politics of paganism, not politics in the sense of a position like Democrat or Republican, that's not what I mean, but that there's a kind of world picture, a sort of way of distributing power that can in some way speak to the kind of religious crisis of our society, or at least has a particular perspective on it.
Yeah. Well, I think there's a lot of growth. I mean, among all the witches and pagans I know, there are certain fundamental values for nature and being aware that human beings have a lot more psychological and especially psychic abilities than people generally recognize. You know, one thing I look at is that both, evangelical or any other kind of religious fundamentalists and, you know, the devout atheists are both, childish. Because it's a much more sophisticated model. And actually, it was the poet William Blake who came up with it first. In his poetry, he would write his songs of innocence are very childlike, okay? And his idea was this is a stage of childhood where you simply accept everything that you're taught and think that it's true. And then the songs of experience, which are really songs of adolescence where you start questioning, and they're much darker. But then he talked about going on to a next stage, which he called organized innocence, where you begin seeing those apparently childlike beliefs in a new light. And at that stage, religion takes on a very different appearance. Very often, you know, going to that stage involves having some kind of, you know, enlightenment experience, mystic experience. There's not even a standard terminology for describing what those experiences are like. And then there's a Myers-Briggs scale, which I wish I could find again, but I know I saw it, that goes on to levels 4, 5, and 6 of this kind of spiritual evolution, with level 6 being only for, you know, the incredible world geniuses like St. Francis of Assisi. You come up with other examples, you know. So what I look at here is, you know, a debate between biblical literalists and devout atheists is, no, neither side understands what religion can truly be about.
When you invoke Blake and we talk about this wonderful idea of organized innocence, what comes to me again is this idea that what, from a secular perspective, you could describe as the imagination, or as poetry, or as ritual, as a performance, as a sort of aesthetic, a social process. You know, these are all secular ways of describing things that people do. That these things have the power to produce the kinds of changes that, for many people, not everyone perhaps, but for many people, are sort of incontrovertible. Like once you've had the experience, the initiation, the download, the communication, the experience, you change.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you can still account for all those things in non-religious language, and then once you allow those changes to begin to feedback in your life, well, then you're in a very different place. It's not so literal a place, but it's still a place of realities, not just of fantasies, social games. There's some other kind of something else that sort of kicks in, bringing up Blake, bringing up the notion, exalted notion of poetry, that romantic idea, still seems very relevant, at least to me. And clearly had a lot to do with your own. I mean, you're a writer, you're a poet, and yet your poetry was a liturgy.
Mm-hmm. Some of it was, yeah.
Yeah.
No, really, it was my high school senior English teacher reading as Blake's The Tiger. Wham! That got me hooked on poetry right then. And he's always been one of my favorite writers. Something I have been thinking about this apparent conflict between religion and science, which it isn't really, you know, it's a particular type of religion, and it's not science that's the problem. I mean, technically, science constitutes the scientific method, period, and you can use that to study anything. What you're dealing with here is what some people call scientism, you know, which is a philosophy about science. So you will have people saying, well, you have to come up with a non-disprovable hypothesis in order to do scientific research. So a non-disprovable hypothesis isn't scientific and therefore isn't worth anything. Well, the problem is, Karl Popper and George Gurdjieff both came up with this idea of a partition, that any statement that can be proved true or false by any conceivable evidence falls in the province of science, can be investigated by scientific method. And religious concepts have to be non-disprovable. Okay? Now, what that means in a science point of view, if it's non-disprovable, you have no idea whether it's true or false. You can't know. But these non-disprovable hypotheses are going to have practical consequences.
Right.
And it was William James who said, be pragmatic. Ask, does it work? Okay? And, the best example I can think of, these type of hypotheses are values. And values are not based on facts. It can't be disproved by facts. And obviously, one of the most important is the simple idea is that human life is valuable. Or beyond that, human life is infinitely valuable. You can either prove that or disprove it, but if you don't believe it, you're likely to be a very unpleasant type of human being. So it does have practical consequences, like James said it would.
Yes, and that's that kind of the kind of pragmatism you're talking about. Does it work? Let's not worry about where it comes from, but how it functions. Let's follow the effects. That's a perspective that can live quite well alongside scientific and technical thinking. And of course, another one of the interesting sociological facts about paganism, at least in the United States, but I think it's true, at least some of the things I've read about British Wicca and paganism, is that there are a lot of scientists and technical people who are involved in the field. There's a lot of very smart people who are working within or on the edge of a lot of scientific and technical discourses, and even just the role of science fiction in the picture reminds you that there is a kind of imaginative side or a kind of a visionary side of these practices as well that really makes room for this. But the question I want to ask you is that I know you're doing historical research. You haven't been as active in the scene as you were at earlier points in your life. But I can't help it, especially because we've been talking about these issues of networking and social organization to some degree, to reflect on how significant the change is that's represented by the internet in terms of how paganism, how people self-identify, how they find each other, how they practice, how the community organizes and imagines itself. It's a very different situation. Can you enlighten us a little on that?
Yeah. Well, for one thing, the spin model of the elders who've known each other forever, with the internet, that's a reality. We can get together on the net and have a conversation, or easily get hold of one another. So all of a sudden you do have this very, very active virtual council of elders. And it's had some interesting manifestations. I don't know. I mean, there have been some problems that have come up publicly. And the elders have actually gotten together and discussed what to do about it. That doesn't happen very often, but we're there. I mean, and I can get messages to and from others about specific things. You also have the concept of the virtual coven, that people will have an ISBET online, with everyone calling the quarters and doing everything, and the ones I've talked to swear that it works, that they feel the energy, because this energy isn't bound by time and space, and sort of the old line witches are looking at this and saying, that's not really the craft, blah, blah. Well, no, it is. It's what it's evolved into. And there was a very interesting book by a colleague, Doug Cowan, about this phenomenon of how the craft functions with the Internet.
What's that book called?
Oh, dear, I don't remember his exact title. But
no
his
sweat.
Name is Doug Cowan, C-O-W-A-N, which is sort of ironic. But
that is a marvelous and funny name. Well, I'm actually very happy to hear you have a positive spin on it, because I do, you know, I have spoken to other people who sort of, you know, lament some of the way in which you kind of had to meet in person, and there was something about the gathering of bodies in particular environments, particularly spaces outside, that were seen to be sort of almost necessary, and it feels like there's this whole other dimension that's opened up. And I think people's spiritual identities are even more invented, reconstructed, unraveled, and reformed on the fly in the environment of the Internet, so that the kind of strands of more traditional strands of Wicca or paganism are themselves getting bound up in fantasy fiction and gaming and all sorts of other kind of domains in a very interesting way. Do you feel that what is unique about paganism or about witchcraft in our contemporary world that marks it as its own kind of current in comparison to the New Age, comparison to more traditional religions that are, of course, always being revitalized in their own ways? What's the particular sort of flavor or message or spirit that current that you've written so thoroughly about represents for us?
Well, I'm not sure. You know, a good part of what propelled my group and a lot of other pagans like this was just a sense that none of the existing churches and religions were adequate, that were not meeting our needs. So there's been not a focus, but just an ongoing theme of figuring out things about all of those existing churches and whatnot that weren't working and figuring out something that would work better. And that's an ongoing process. I mean, we're going through an overall world evolution that began with the Industrial Revolution. It's not done yet. But the whole pagan movement, you know, that expands, you know, here and internationally, is poised to provide a set of values that can work with whatever, you know, our global civilization is going to evolve into. It's kind of parallel to the way that the Irish revolutionaries created the Green Party, and they were the ones who set off the movement to the European Union. Personally, as a leftist, you know, I can see maybe in a century we actually have a federal world government that has the same kind of relationship to member nations as our federal government has to the states. You know, they all work together, but each state has its own culture, obviously. And with a federal, which was invented by the Iroquois, which is wonderful. They were the ones who came up with the concept, and it's grown since then.
That was kind of the part of the model that you guys were working on. One of the things you're talking about in your book is the organization of the Covenant of the Goddess, mm-hmm. which is a really interesting experiment with real political effects in what do you do when you have a lot of very independent, small groups, creative differences, you know, a very dynamic, distributed field of groups with their own agendas. How do you bring them together? How do you crystallize a larger body that's not repressive but can still articulate values on a more general level? I mean, that worked pretty well, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, the idea of having some kind of church organization, at least something that can provide legal benefits, the earliest person I know thinking about that was Michael Kinghorn in Los Angeles. And he got together with Fred McAdams, and then they connected with Harold Moss and so on, you know, and there were these meetings going on trying to figure out how to do that. Gradually it focused down. All these disparate groups didn't have enough in common, and we could figure out a structure. It finally got to the point where Gwydion and Allison and I and some other people dawned on us, you know, if we had a church that was just for witches, it just used that structure, that we can see how to do. But, of course, the problem was, well, you can't become a witch by joining a church. That's silly. And no witch is going to put up with a church telling them whether they're a witch or not. So how do you do this? And oddly enough, Cotton Mather mentioned at some point that witches were organized like Congregationalists. And those poor people in Salem Village probably were Congregationalists. But we wondered what he meant, and so I went and looked up the charter of what was now the United Church of Christ that the Congregationalists merged into. And right there in the charter, we saw the idea. Individuals are members of their congregations, and it's the congregations that are members of the national church. And we looked at that, and we said, substitute covens for churches, and it works. You're still initiated by a coven. It's the coven who decides it. That's how you become a witch. But the covens can join a national organization. And, you know, we got this meeting together of, I don't know, it's at least 20 people or more from all kinds of different traditions and went over that, and we all agreed, yeah, that can work. So then we started the process, and by June of 1970, I mean, this was in 3 months, we had the meeting to sign the actual covenant by representatives of covens to found the Covenant of the Goddess. And we pretty much picked the word covenant because it contains the word coven, and we didn't want to call it a church.
Yeah.
And then it has worked because of that two-level structure. It's hitting, you know, it's 40 years old now, quite to my surprise.
And how are the dynamics in terms of the kind of covens that are represented in the Covenant of the Goddess now? I mean, is it are there new groups coming in? Is it a little bit more of a settled period in terms of the major Wiccan groups? How dynamic is that?
Well, as far as I know, it's continuing to evolve. I haven't been keeping close tabs on it at all. I helped create it, but I didn't want to run it. You know, I wouldn't let them elect me as first officer. I had to get back to my doctoral program at that point. But it has continued to evolve. I mean, we set it up purposely that it didn't constitute just Gardnerian covens. We made sure the Dianics could come in, the traditional pre-Gardnerian witches could come in like this. You know, just thinking of the whole craft movement in a very broad sense. And it has maintained, you know, that kind of broadness. And it's, you know, one of the best, wonderful stories I know, and I heard it from Judy Harrow, who was there, that at the Second World Parliament of Religions in 1993, you know, the century after the first one, they set it up so there would be a grand entrance march like at the Olympics. And so they were in a staging area. And so the Covenant of the Goddess was right next to the Catholic Archdiocese of Chicago. So Phyllis Curat, who was first officer at that point, got to chat with Cardinal Bernardin, I think it was, and was just standing there. So later on, Cog had put in a request to do a ritual in the park, and the Parks Department turned it down. And so on live television, Phyllis turned to the Cardinal and said, "Sir, could you please use your influence to guarantee the rights of your fellow citizens are honored?" And, of course, the poor man on live TV couldn't do anything but say yes. So he used it, and the circle was held on the exact spot where the riots broke out at the 1968 Democratic Convention. It was chosen on purpose, right? And there were representatives of almost every religion in the world in that circle. And they got to see Phyllis work this ritual, this goddess liturgy. And everybody went home from there with this sense of, you know, the goddess is a real factor in the world now. It got, you know, national headlines. And I felt really good. I felt really good that I was able to start something that could have that kind of effect.
Well, Aidan, that's a wonderful story to end on. We're going to have to close it up here. Thanks so much for joining us on Expanding Mind.
I thank you very much, Eric, and remind people again to please buy my book.
Absolutely. Check out Aidan's book online, and the new one is called A Tapestry of Witches, and I must give a shout-out as well to Hippie Commie Beatnik Witches, an amazing personal tale of the 60s and 70s. It's a great, great book.
Well, thank you.
So with that said, from me to all you out there, keep your minds open.